Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
We begin in Syria this hour. 5,000 dead, most of them civilians, most of them protesters. Over the last 10 months, that's the death toll from the uprising in Syria. Syrian security forces have killed more than 5,000 protesters across the country, again, according to the United Nations. And what we've seen over the last several weeks is the Arab League, which negotiated a deal to get peace monitors inside of Syria to actually monitor what security forces were doing. In the midst of that monitoring mission, the president of Syria strongly criticized the Arab League, utterly discredited them in a public address to not only the domestic audience inside Syria, but to the entire world. Over the weekend, the Arab League has called for a more international interventionist policy in Syria, asking the United Nations to get involved, extending the mandate of the peacekeeping mission, but really upping the rhetoric. What can the Arab League do to influence the situation inside Damascus? And are there any allies for the Arab League, such as the United Nations or even the international community, including members of the Security Council itself? Joshua Landis joins us, co-director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He's author of the blog Syria Comment. He joins us via Skype. Welcome to the program, Josh.
It's a pleasure.
So I'm a little befuddled here. If the Arab League can't accomplish anything by being inside of Syria in the form of peace monitors, what can it accomplish influencing from the outside, calling on the United Nations and even the Security Council? And the Russians have threatened to veto any move in the Security Council that's taken against Syria.
Well, the short answer is not very much. I mean, the Arab League is as divided as the West is on this issue.
And so how do you, I mean, it certainly seems that on the ground the situation is deteriorating. How do you sort of square the reports of brutality with what seems to be plaintiff calls for intervention that really can't go anywhere?
Well, nobody wants to intervene, and that's the big problem. The Arab League is divided. There are two major blocks, one led by Qatar and the emir there, who wants intervene in action. His people, he only has 200,000 citizens. They make about $80,000 a year, the richest people in the world. He's very secure. He wants to lead. Others in the Arab world are much less eager to do this. There's another bloc, Iraq, Algeria, Lebanon, who have voted against it. So they've been divided. That's why we're seeing this policy for asking the president of Syria to step down, which he says he will not do, and for elections and extending the presence of this observer outfit in Syria, but it's a compromise.
The extension of the Arab monitoring mission is the compromise, is what you're saying.
It is, and asking him to step down without any foreign pressure.
And let's talk about who has a stake here. You've described the Prime Minister of Qatar, the Emir of Qatar, who has a stake in becoming a regional player. At what point do you evaluate his sort of personal interest in getting a lot of headlines by talking about Syria versus having some significant influence inside Syria?
Well, that's his problem. He doesn't have tons of influence because even within the Gulf, which has been the most aggressive part of this, because they're the Sunnis, they would like this Shiite-led government in Syria to fall so it would move out of the orbit of Iran and into the orbit of Saudi Arabia. The United States shares those interests. So the Gulf has been the prime mover for bringing down the Syrian government. But even Saudi Arabia doesn't want military intervention because, as a monarchy, it would set a precedent because the eastern provinces of Saudi Arabia are full of Shiites, and they've been demanding the downfall of the Saudi household. Bahrain, majority Shiite, the Saudis moved troops in there to suppress that revolution. So the Saudis are living in a glass house. They have withdrawn from their members of this monitoring. So they're not even following the emir.
Although the reason they gave for withdrawing is because Syrian government broke promises. It did seem to be critical, but I take your point that it's the glass house issue. If Saudi Arabia is a glass house, though, what is Lebanon? You mentioned that Lebanon doesn't want an intervention either, or doesn't want things to be ramped up any more than it already is. It just seems to me that Lebanon...
Well, Hezbollah
right.
is the dominant player in Lebanon. That's a Shiite group that's allied with Syria and Iran.
But why wouldn't even Hezbollah want an orderly transition in Syria versus waiting for something to completely blow up? I mean, that would bear directly on stability in Lebanon.
Well, it would. The trouble with an orderly transition is to what? To a pro-Saudi, pro-U.S. government that would destroy Hezbollah? I don't think you.
Right.
So, and many people in the region believe that Assad may beat this.
And do people in the region have confidence that Assad can weather this like his father did years ago?
Well, nobody really knows. But the point is right now the opposition in Syria is in disarray. They've got numbers, they've got courage, they're getting more and more guns, they're getting foreign support. But they're weak, and they haven't been able to move out of these core cities that they've been working in. And they have called for the end of this monitoring mission. Their leader, Burhan Khalilun, is under attack by their own membership, who've called him a dictator. They don't like that he has opened negotiations with some other opposition groups. So there's a lot of disarray within the opposition. So it's not clear where things are going right now.
Joshua Landis is our guest. He's co-director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Well, then, as we go out, how do you assess and use as many examples as you like? We're seeing reform in Burma without military intervention, and we're seeing the Arab Spring, and we're seeing, of course, Libya, which had extraordinary military intervention. How do you rank the sort of humanitarian urgency of what's going on in Syria right now?
Well, the trouble is even the West, their Arab states are calling for this to go to the UN. The trouble is the West doesn't want to intervene any more than the Arab states do. The United States, Obama, is running his campaign on, I got America out of these costly, bad missions in the Middle East. The last thing he wants to do is jump back in. He might follow if Turkey or the Arab League led a military intervention. He could lend support to it, but he doesn't want to jump into the middle of a civil war.
I don't want to sound cynical. It's the year of the dragon in the Chinese New Year. If I was Bashar al-Assad, I would be feeling pretty confident at this point. Is that
well,
right?
And I think he is. And so he's playing rope-a-dope with the Arab League and with the West. And he's trying to he's keeping, in a sense, even though the death rate is mounting and the situation is terrible in Syria, he has been trying to keep it down, to ward off this foreign intervention.
And holding his own. Joshua
and
Landis.
He's holding his own, although the economy is deteriorating. It's fallen. The income of Syrians has fallen 50% in the last
all
9 months.
All part of the humanitarian urgency there. Joshua Landis, co-director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, Wither Syria. Thanks so much, Josh. And moving away from the Middle East now at 15 minutes after the hour, let's take a look at some other headlines. We begin in Mississippi, where a judge today will decide the future of prisoners pardoned by former Governor Haley Barbour. In his final days, Governor Barbour pardoned more than 200 people, including 14 convicted murderers. The Mississippi State Attorney General stepped in to challenge those pardons. At today's hearing, the judge can void the pardons and send the inmates back to prison. The annual March for Life rally is today in Washington, marking the anniversary of the Roe v. Wade decision legalizing abortion. House Speaker John Boehner is scheduled to address the crowd. He says in a statement that he's honored to do so and to lead the House's, quote, bipartisan pro-life majority. State funding for higher education has declined by some $6 billion, or nearly 8% over the past year. That's according to a new study out today. Researchers say the slow recovery from the recession and the end of federal stimulus money has caused the drop in funding. Total state support for higher education has declined in 41 U.S. states. You're listening to The Takeaway, where you can always tell us your view at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we'll be looking back to the 90s. Newt Gingrich was big in that decade. He was one of the hits. You might have heard his name lately, okay? He roars out of South Carolina, and is looking back at Newt Gingrich going to be looking back at that decade? Here are a few other names you may remember from the 90s. Monica Lewinsky, oh sure. O.J. Simpson, oh my goodness. James Cameron, of course. T2, he was the king of the world back then. We want to hear your greatest hits of the 90s. Give us your view at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We'll take a 90s look back at the former Speaker of the House coming up in just a moment.